Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Total Film's Last Picture Show. The elevator pitch? It's the end of the world, and you have one last night at the cinema to watch four films on the big screen. Which four are you programming, and why? Our guest today is a Welsh filmmaker who started acting as a kid but made a big impression as the lead in Richard Ayoade's Submarine. He's appeared in Jane Eyre, The Double, Bad Neighbours, 22 Jump Street and Kill Your Friends before making a move to writing and directing with Just Jim. He followed that up with Eternal Beauty, and now he's on his third film, The Phantom of the Open. That tells the story of a wannabe pro golfer, Maurice Flitcroft, who'd never played a round before and against all odds entered the British Open in 1976. It stars Mark Rylance as the fabulous Maurice.
And he's done it. It just goes to show if you put your mind to it, you can achieve anything you want to.
I'm going to have a crack at the British Open.
Golf!
The British Open is the most respected tournament in the world.
I never even played bloody golf before, Dad.
Mind your language on the course. F***ing hell.
It says professional. You sure?
Well, practice is the road to perfection.
Welcome on the tee, Maurice Flitcroft.
Don't adjust the television. This is actually happening.
Okay, so our guest today is Craig Roberts. Thank you for coming on the Last Picture Show.
Thanks for having me. Thanks so much.
We'll get on to your film choices in a little bit, but probably we should start at the beginning of cinema life for you and ask, what was the first film you saw at the cinema on a big screen?
Oh, good question. I remember watching the first Lord of the Rings. That's probably not the first film I saw, but I do remember that being quite the thing. And I was just blown away by it, seeing that, you know, in a packed cinema and just going into that world. I love that. I remember the first film I ever saw, which was a VHS of Rover Dangerfield. Not many people have seen this film, and I'm no question whether it exists or not, but it's, it stars Rodney Dangerfield, and it's an animation about a dog who gets kicked out and goes to Vegas to become a show dog. If you haven't seen it, it's worth a watch.
I haven't seen it, and I'm now going to seek that out because that sounds weird. And
it is weird.
Yeah.
Very strange. It's very dark. My grandfather bought it for me. So that was the first film I saw, and I watched it loads. I just watched it loads. But I think probably Lord of the Rings, the first one, is the first one I remember just being like, wow, this is incredible.
The majesty of the cinema. Obviously, you've been an actor in the, since your Lord of the Rings experience and moved on to being a filmmaker. And your latest film is The Phantom of the Open. Tell me, first of all, about the transition from actor to filmmaker. When did that happen for you? And what was it that made you want to direct as well as act and sort of take control of a project a bit more?
Early 20s is when it kicked in. I think the seed was planted when I made a movie called Submarine with Richard Ayoade. During the prep of that, he handed me a bunch of films. And one of them is actually my selection, which is Punch Drunk Love. And I watched it during Submarine and I loved it. But later, a couple of years later, I watched it again. And my mind was blown with just how many layers there were in the movie and just, you know, how PTA told the story, really, of this person that is suffering with social anxiety, but kind of romanticizes it and puts it through like a lens of him being an alien of sorts. Like when I found out that Punch Drunk Love was actually about, you know, he was Superman, he was Clark Kent, and he didn't know how to use his powers, my mind was blown. I was like, this is incredible. So that movie definitely helped. And then I think when I was doing interviews for the acting jobs, people ask you, like, you know, who are your inspirations, or who do you, you know, whose work do you admire? I was just saying filmmakers rather than actors. Not that I don't admire actors' work, but I think my heart was in maybe what was behind camera. So, and probably out of fear of not being able to sustain an acting career as well. Like, you know, you do get pigeonholed, and there's only so many roles I could do that's, you know, Benjamin Braddock reincarnated, you know, like The Graduate. So, I think that was probably a bit of everything, really. And to just to challenge myself, and I suppose I wanted a change, and yeah, and I'm glad I did, to be honest.
Yeah. So obviously we got Just Jim and Eternal Beauty, and this is now The Phantom of the Open, and a sort of different tone from the previous films you've done. Tell me about how you found this story, because it's not something that a lot of people are aware of, this guy that entered the British Open having never played a round of golf before, and there he is, you know, with all the pros on the green. How did it come to you? Was it at script form, or had you heard of it before then?
Yeah, Simon had written the script and it was already, there was a really good draft of it. And Simon actually came to London Film Festival to see Eternal Beauty, my second film. And I think they just liked the tone of it and they liked how it dealt with an outsider, I suppose, that, you know, it was constructed in a way that you weren't meant to laugh at them, you're supposed to laugh with. And I think that probably worked for their script. So I read the script and I loved it. I loved it. And it's interesting. It is a different tone to the first two films I made. And that's mainly, I think, because I didn't write the script. Right. I think it's, you know, it's when I look at it, when I had it, I was like, my God, I could never write anything this commercial or accessible. So I have to do this. Like all the stuff that I write is slightly abstract and really out there. So that I saw as a challenge. And then it was just about really finding my way into it. And I was worried about doing somebody else's script because for me, it blows my mind that the people that write scripts can hand it over, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like if you create a world, it's amazing for somebody to be able to hand it over. I could never do that. So yeah, it was about staying true to, you know, Simon's material and the obviously Morris and his spirit, but also finding my way into it. And weirdly, there was a scene, and it's going to go back to Punch Drunk again, but there was a scene where in the script that Morris comes out of the shipyard and he opens his overalls like Superman. And as soon as I read that, I was like, Punch Drunk Love. I was like, okay, so maybe there's a way of putting that in there somewhere. So actually throughout the movie, there's just loads of little Easter eggs that he's Superman.
Oh, I'm going to have to rewatch it now.
Yeah, actually somebody watched it, I think at like a Cineworld screening the other day, and they'd figured it. I didn't think anyone would figure it out because it's so hidden, but the number plate is his name, and somebody saw that, which is good. So that made me happy.
Cool. I love it when there's Easter eggs. That's brilliant. So you talked about the fact that, you know, not laughing at Morris, but laughing with him. Was it important that you totally believed this guy was for real? Because obviously he tried to enter the open several times under all sorts of crazy names, Arnold Palmtree being one of the brilliant ones, and Baron von something or another. So to some people, he may be sort of looked at as a con man rather than a sort of dreamer. Was it important that you identified with that side of it and that that's how we're presenting him here?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And that comes with Mark, really. Mark's such a great actor that he's able to ground absolutely everything. And he's incredibly relatable as an actor. So, you know, in his performances. So that was really there. I mean, the tone was great. But with Mark, when he came on and we talked about the script, he was all about grounding it and not playing to the comedy too much. And I felt that was right as well. A reference that I had in my head was The King of Comedy. And mainly because it's such a fantastic movie, obviously, but there's no better setup for me than somebody that thinks they're funny and everybody's telling him he's not funny. Like, that's so great. And that felt really right for Morris. And it's weird. I just mentioned this a minute ago, but the new Kanye West documentary has just come out and I watched that and I loved it. It's fantastic. And whether you like Kanye or, you know, are behind what he says and stuff like that, there's something really inspiring about, certainly in the earlier episodes of that documentary, of him going into these record labels and being like, I am great. I can do it. And I think it's refreshing. I think we're always told to be humble and play it down, but sometimes you've really got to believe in yourself. And I think even though, you know, it didn't work out for Morris like it did for Mr. West, but I like that. I like that a lot about the story. You know, he's defying his birth lottery, you know, yeah, the cards that were dealt and going against it. And I think that's probably why people like underdog's story so much, because it's proper escapism. It's what can you do if you really put your mind to it? And I feel like, you know, now's a good time, hopefully, for people to have some form of escapism.
Yeah, absolutely. We need it more than ever. You know, it's interesting hearing you talk about that, because it does sound like the life of an actor, really, that you putting yourself forward for roles and you have to really be like, I absolutely can do this. Is that something that you sort of identify with, that element of Morris's psychology?
Yeah, to be honest, it's actually more so with filmmaking. With my first couple of films that I made, you really have to go into these rooms with people that have the money and be like, this is going to be amazing. And you're questioning whether it's going to be amazing yourself. You really don't know, because obviously nobody sets out to make a bad movie, but nobody really knows what the secret ingredients are to a great movie. It's kind of, you know, more than the sum of its parts. It just comes together somehow when the stars align. That, yeah, certainly with like the filmmaking side of it, like going into rooms and having to present the Mr. West of yourself and say that you could do this. I certainly relate to 100%.
Yeah, you talked about the underdog, and this is sort of, it sort of reminded me a little bit of Forrest Gump in a way, this sort of idea of, you know, just going for your dreams and having no sort of reality infect that idea. Is that something that you like to watch as well as a film goer, that the underdog story and the dreamer. Are there other films like that that you sort of looked at when you were making this that represented it? I mean, you mentioned other films before, but were there other ones you looked at?
In terms of underdog story, I mean, I always look to 8 Mile, and I know that's a really weird reference, but I love 8 Mile. It's like the rap Rocky. I suppose with 8 Mile, there's a way of shooting that movie where it does feel like a full-on biopic of Marshall Mathers, and it can be, I suppose it could be bright and more appealing to certain audiences, but it's really gritty and it's grounded. 8 Mile, it's really gritty, and it's beautifully shot. That wasn't a reference for this movie. I never mentioned 8 Mile to people, but I think when we were making this, I definitely didn't want to make a down the line like kind of biopic, you know, where it's all super, super bright and super, super positive all the time. I don't think life is like that. And I think that's why we, hopefully it looks slightly different to the normal biopic. We try to shoot on film and try to, I suppose, just again, ground it in a strange way, because there are like moments of fantasy and elements of like escaping and stuff in the movie. But I think it's nice to have a bit of both of, you know, if you can ground it more in reality, then hopefully those kind of Billy Liar moments feel more true to the character.
Mm. So let's talk about your first film then. The first film you chose is
Punch Drunk Love.
I have so much strength in me, you have no idea. I have a love in my life. It makes me stronger than anything you can imagine.
Tell me about Punch Drunk Love. You've obviously mentioned it already, and that it was sort of formative in making you think about being a filmmaker, but tell me more about what it is that you love about the film and why you think it should be seen on a big screen.
I think it's Paul Thomas Anderson's best film. Every film he's made is his best film, but I think for me that, I don't know, I love how small it feels compared to his other films. Obviously, you know, when you put it next to There Will Be Blood, it feels like a completely different filmmaker. I love the choices really in it. I love the choice of using Adam Sandler, and I think that's just so inspiring that, you know, it's kind of the pre-Uncut Gems Adam Sandler. You know, it's like everyone nuts for Adam Sandler and Uncut Gems, but it's right there in Punch Drunk Love as well. I feel like those two are a great double bill, actually. Yeah. Uncut Gems is fantastic as well. If there was a fifth, I'd probably put that in there. I love the colors of it all, really. I love the, like, again, going back to the Superman thing, once you know that he's Clark Kent, or he's an alien, or he's Superman being beamed down, at the beginning of the movie in John Bryan's score, you can hear kind of like aliens talking, and then you hear ping, and then like the music starts. So that's literally him being beamed to Earth. And then, like, you know, he wears the blue suit the whole time, and he's got the red tie. And one thing that stuck out to me the most was like the final scene where Emily Watson is behind him while he's playing the piano, and she's got the red dress, and he says, you know, here we go. And she wraps her arms around him, and then her red dress wrapping the arms around him is essentially the cape going onto him. So he's essentially ready to fly. And I was like, oh, this is just, it's just so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And throughout the movie, he's collecting, like, you know, stamps, or he's collecting vouchers so he can, you know, get air miles to essentially fly. The whole Superman thing is like, seems so obvious once you know it, but it was so hard to, I think it was Mark Kermode that actually started talking about it. And then loads of people did like videos of, you know, the layers within it. The score is always a reference for like any movie I've done has been a reference, the syncopated sound of it, and just how strange it is, but also very beautiful and romantic. Yeah, I think that's the best rom-com in the world.
Wow. Okay. Fighting talk, but okay. And as you say, it does look beautiful. It's beautiful cinematography and everything, which would look gorgeous on your big screen. So this is a fantastic film to open with. In this program that you're putting on, what cinema would you be putting it on at? What's your favorite cinema to sit in and watch a big film?
Probably two, actually. One would be the Showcase Cinema in Nangaroo in Wales, only because that's where I grew up. That's where I went to watch all the movies with my parents. And hopefully I'm going to go down next week and watch Phantom of the Opera when it comes out there.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I just have so many great memories. But probably Prince Charles, probably the best place would be to do that. They do the all-nighters, so I'd probably do an all-nighter of all four of those films with pizzas and beers and have a good time.
Yeah, sounds good. Tell me about your second film. What's your second choice that you're putting on?
Meet the Parents, I believe.
I I don't know what it is, but there's just something about him that's a little off.
It's an antique polygraph machine.
Why don't you try that on?
That's okay.
Oh, come on. We'll have some fun.
Greg, my father was never in the rare flower business.
Don't worry. You'll enjoy this. Oh.
Have you ever watched pornographic videos?
No.
Relax, relax. The needles are jumping.
He was in the CIA for 34 years.
Great. Yeah, I was scared of your dad back when I thought he was a florist.
I'm a patient man. That's what 19 months in a Vietnamese prison camp will do to you. But I will be watching you, studying your every move. And I will bring you down, baby. I will bring you down to Chinatown.
It's the film I watch every Christmas. It's a film that makes me feel, if I feel anxious at all, I can just put that movie on and completely escape. The writing is just next. It's the best. Like, there's, for situation comedy, it's just like, it's so, so good. And again, the casting choices were fantastic. Ben Stiller and De Niro opposite each other. You can't really get any better than that. And De Niro is just so funny in it. It's so quotable as well. I think probably one of the best scenes in cinema for me is like the scene with the urn where he pops the champagne and it, you know, it hits the urn and then it all the ashes fall. And yeah, and De Niro is reading the poem to his mum, to his dead mum. I just think it's so, so good.
I mean, everybody, it's so such a relatable film, isn't it, as well? Everybody's gone to somebody's house, whether it's your in-laws or not, and had an uncomfortable stay with somebody.
Yeah, exactly. It would also be a great movie to watch with an audience because everybody's going to be laughing the whole time. I also feel like it's kind of rare to get movies like that nowadays, I feel. There's an innocence in those movies, and not that we've lost our innocence, I think, with cinema, but cinema's certainly, you know, it reflects society in some kind of way, and it's darker than it was. And I'd love to see people make like a Meet the Parents or something like that. I just feel just the tone of it is just it's so welcoming, and yeah, just makes me feel warm, very safe.
Well, they are bringing back the sort of romancing the stone genre with The Lost City. So that's starting to happen. We're starting to see that romantic adventure. So maybe we'll get back into the Meet the Parents as well. Let's hope so, because it is a cracker. The cat is also excellent. tell me about your third film, which is a completely different type of funny from this.
Yes, it is. So third film would be A Pigeon Sat on a Branch and Reflected on Existence. By Roy Anderson. What's not to say about it, really? It certainly would be a darker turn if everyone was doing these four movies back to back, but it is still a comedy and it is very, very funny. It's hard really to sum up his movies because they're so unique. He's such an individual. Like, it's so authored, and doing everything in one shot sometimes seems like a magic trick, and sometimes that can take, you know, can take you away. But the fact that he has these vignettes that just play out in a, like a painting, in that kind of tableau vivant framing, it's just absolutely wonderful. I suppose the more accessible version of him would be Wes Anderson, because they're very similar in a weird way, I suppose, in terms of their framings and stuff.
Yeah.
And how offbeat they are, but I've actually not seen his new film, but I wish he could just keep on making films because they're fantastic.
It's also got a very specific palette, hasn't it? And sort of this look. Is that something that you sort of thought, oh, one day I'm going to do one of those that's very beige in a very amusing fashion?
Interestingly, with like my second film, Eternal Beauty, that was definitely a reference for the earlier stuff, because the movie was about a character that was living with paranoid schizophrenia. And I used that kind of, yeah, everything's very pale. Everything's kind of eggshell. And even the faces in Pigeon, I think he even paints the faces to look, you know, just for them to almost look ill. And that was definitely a reference for us at the beginning of Eternal Beauty, because she's on her medication. So everything is kind of that plain. And I suppose the character is pulled out. And then when she came off medication, it kind of, the hybrid of Punch Drunk, where we started to bring the blues and stuff like that in. When you watch a Roy Anderson film, you'll never see another film like it, really. They're one of a kind. Yeah. But I feel like, yeah, my sense of humor normally lies towards the darker end of the spectrum. I feel like I find Taxi Driver funny. I feel like Travis Bickle walking around being super serious is funny. So that, yeah, I think that's a good kind of palate cleanser in between full-on comedies.
Yeah. It's interesting though, you said you sort of wouldn't have made such a commercial film as The Phantom of the Open. Has that changed now you've made that? Has that changed your idea of what you might do next? Or are you just going to go full on dark, 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 funny?
The next one's very dark, actually. And nobody will probably ever see it compared to Phantom. I think what's dangerous for filmmakers is that they're told that, you know, things have to be commercial and stuff like that. And I think probably filmmakers sometimes get lost with what that means, and that it has to be gag after gag after gag. And I don't think that's the case. I just think it needs to be accessible, and it needs to have universal themes. And that's one thing I've learned with Phantom of the Open, is that it's a movie for everybody, really. And that's what makes it commercial. So, yeah, I definitely want to make movies that people see.
Yes,
that's definitely the aim. But the next one's definitely going to be darker for sure.
Yeah, and how's it feeling now for you in terms of what you choose to act in and what you choose to direct? How are you sort of picking projects on that basis?
Well, with acting, if whatever comes in, really, if anybody will have me, I'm happy to play. With directing, it's harder with directing, because as an actor, you can make a good film and you can have a load of bad films and it doesn't really matter. Whereas with directing, if you make a bad film, you're not really coming back from it. Mm. So I think my time is certainly spent focusing on like what the right decision is next as a director or as a writer director. And for me, that's going to be, the next project will be something I've written and directed. So it'll be strange.
Let's go to your fourth film, which is a cracker, one of my favourites. It is
The Mask, with Jim Carrey.
It's like it brings your innermost desires to life. You become some sort of a love-crazy wild man.
I want him here tomorrow, alive.
Now, you have to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Do you? Bunks?
That's definitely one of the earlier films I watched in my life. That made me want to be an actor, for sure. Anything that Jim Carrey did or does made me want to be an actor. And I suppose the whole metaphor of putting that mask on, you know, kind of in some ways, I suppose spilled into like the films that I've made. Like even my first film, Just Jim, it was about somebody trying to be somebody else. And with Eternal Beauty, it was about people not accepting who you are as a person. And with Phantom, it's certainly about putting the mask on. I mean, he puts many masks on. So weirdly, I think that's more than I probably know has informed who I am as a person, and also as a filmmaker. I also just love the look of it. It feels like the Flintstones film. Like it just, I love the look of it. And in the 90s, it seems that people were obsessed with that really dark blue. It's like it's almost like taking the French New Wave, like Day for Night blue, and then like really pushing it even darker. So like it feels completely heightened to the point where I'm sure nobody's made this comparison and ever will again, but even with Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, like all that movie is full of that blue. So like that must have been the message spread out in the 90s, that they loved that really, really dark blue. And I just love the way it looks. Yeah, it feels like the Flintstones. I don't know why it feels like the Flintstones to me, but there's something about it that just feels otherworldly.
Yeah. What's your favorite scene? Do you have one?
Probably the first time the mask goes on is probably one of my favorite scenes. I also love the scene. There's a big crane shot of them going into the club for the first time, and everyone's kind of like dancing outside, and it just follows them in. And I remember that feeling epic to me in terms of the way it looked. But yeah, probably the first time the mask goes on. He's just incredible in it.
Yeah.
He's so good.
Would you like to work with him?
Yeah, who wouldn't? I mean, I think he's just amazing. I think even like when you look at his choices, he's made fantastic choices with like, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. In fact, that probably should have been in my top four as well. That's amazing. Anything Charlie Kaufman comes up with.
Yes, he's incredible. Okay, so those are your four films, but we have some questions about the other accoutrements of going to the cinema. Salty or sweet popcorn, what are you having?
A mix of both, I think. A mix of both. Probably salty, but my partner likes sweet, so I have to normally get the sweet popcorn. If I can get a mix, I'm happy.
Cool. And are you interested in, you know, a bag of Revels or something else on the side, or is it you just sticking with the classic popcorn?
Probably sweets. I'm a sucker for sweets, so any kind of sweets.
Okay, cool. And are you into trailers? Do you like to get to the cinema to watch the trailers, or are you like cruising in just before the film starts?
trailers is my favorite part, to be honest. I love the trailers. So definitely I'm in there. I'm in there before the lights go down, and absolutely love the trailers.
Right. And as the screen, you know, finishes and this night is over and everyone's leaving the cinema, what soundtrack, movie soundtrack, would you be piping out there for them to be making their way home?
Probably Mr. Blue Sky, because it's a really positive song to skip home to.
So Craig's last picture show programme will be Punch Drunk Love, Meet the Parents, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence, and The Mask. Let us know on Twitter if you'd be up for sitting in the dark for that lineup. But for now, thanks for sharing your programme, Craig. We'll be back with another last picture show, so do come back to see who else is in the projectionist booth.
Spoken! It's party time! P-A-R-T. Why? Because I gotta!
Mr. Blue Sky, please tell us why you had to hide away for so long. Why did we go wrong? Mr. Blue Sky, please tell us why you had to hide away for so long.
That was the Last Picture Show podcast from Total Film. Let us know what four films you'd watch at the end of the world. You can tweet us on @TotalFilm or connect with us on Facebook or our Instagram page.